Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Marian Ingram has a stunning, harrowing, fascinating story to tell, and she shares it very graphically in her memoir, The Hands of War, a tale of endurance and hope from a survivor of the Holocaust. Marion, a Jewish child of war, grew up in Hamburg, Germany in the late 1930s, early 40s, the oldest of three girls. Her mother tried to kill herself after receiving a deportation notice. All her family had already been exterminated. The seven-year-old found her and managed to drag her away from the gas oven. That nightmare was followed by the beginning of Operation Gomorrah, 10 days and nights of relentless bombings by U.S. and British air forces in 1943, which Marion describes in terrifying detail. 50,000 civilians were killed. The two miraculously escaped and went into hiding, living in a shed in the woods that belonged to one of her father's pre-war communist friends who had been taking care of Marion's younger sister. Her father, who was not Jewish, was forced to join the Luftwaffe for not abandoning his Jewish wife and children. The war ended, with Marion's immediate family intact, and they returned to a devastated Hamburg. In the 50s, when she was 17, Marion left Europe for the States, where her mother, who had remarried, moved to New York with her youngest sister, and eventually settled in L.A. Marion stayed in New York, attended Hunter College, and wound up modeling for fashion photographers. She met her future husband, Daniel, in 1957. And while for the first time Marion felt safe here, she became very aware of the issue of racial discrimination in this country, impacted by the 1955 murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till of Mississippi, whose killers were found not guilty by an all-white jury. She viewed this as a variation on the racism she experienced in Europe and subsequently became very involved in the civil rights movement, writing, "One of the things that excited me most about the American civil rights movement was the way it chose to fight, by confronting overwhelming power and terror with nonviolent resistance." Marion spent time in Mississippi as a field staff worker for SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and was instrumental in forming the Freedom School in Pascagoula. There is a lot of territory to cover. So let's meet Marion, writer, artist, civil rights activist. Welcome to the 51%.
Thank you, Sandy.
I want to know why you wrote this book.
I wrote it because I started writing it, as a matter of fact, in New York, in the village. It was to allay the terror that I was still plagued by. I needed somehow to exorcise the demons. I had nightmares. I was constantly crouching somewhere if I heard fire sirens, you know, in fire engines going by with sirens. I would try to get someplace out of the way. I found myself behaving in ways that were very strange and, of course, reminiscent of the past.
Not so strange to you, maybe strange
right,
to
yes,
me if I was
yes,
sitting with
yes,
you in that cafe.
Exactly, because, you know, just I would fall apart. And so I decided that maybe if I wrote about it, if I could get it out of my system, I would be able to relieve some of these demons. I had a great deal of difficulty all the time writing about the firestorm because we could not get into fire, into the bomb shelters because we were Jewish. So they were, you know, Jews were not allowed. There would be a big plaque on the side of the door on bomb shelters, and we were not allowed to enter it. So this was a 10-day, 10-night bombing attack of civilians. It was not directed at any military installation, just only at civilian targets. And my mother and I, my youngest sister had been taken by a cousin of my father's, and Helga, my middle sister, was on this ex-urban farm with communist colleagues and of my father's. And so we are running through the streets with, you know, bombs falling, cratered streets, seeing hundreds of dead bodies. bodies floating in the river. Hamburg has an enormous number of canals and two inner city lakes, and people were jumping into the water because phosphorus was used in the firebombing. So these were living torches. People were running through the streets and jumping.
On fire.
On fire. So they would jump into the water and that would douse the flame. But the minute they came back up out of the water, they would be in flame again. At one point during one of the 10 days and 10 nights, I don't exactly remember what number day it was, a policeman just shot the people as they were emerging from the water because they were, you know, I guess, in just agony. Anyway, so I could not write about this. I was always stopped. I had terrible nightmares.
You couldn't write about it because something inside of you stopped you.
So in 1957, I was then living with Daniel, my husband. We were
and
not
you were how
married.
Old?
In 57, I was 21.
Uh-huh. And today you're 77.
I'm 77, okay. Yes.
So you were living with your
husband. I was living with
husband.
My husband, yes. My great love, my one and only great love. And I had one night.
Did he know about your past, by the way?
Yes.
How did you meet people? I mean, this amazing amount of baggage.
I was in school. I actually started as a visual artist. I've always loved writing, but I was a visual artist, and I met him through, you know, just strange circumstances.
But when do you drop this bomb on people?
I did not tell people about.
Well,
this.
Clearly they hear your accent. They know you're not American.
Right?
They know that you came from Europe.
And I would always hedge. I would never really say exactly where I was from because I had traveled a lot, and by that time I avoided it. I just constantly evaded and by omission avoided things. And with Daniel, it was just trust. I just immediately trusted Daniel, and I told him, you know, not everything. But anyway, in 1957, while we were in bed, I suddenly had total recall. And that
was the catalyst for you to put this down on paper?
Well, I had been writing, you know, I'd been trying.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yes, so then I wrote this, and that it didn't immediately relieve the tension, but it lessened it. I became more and more comfortable with that history. I became more resigned to it. And because, as you said, my accent was stronger, but it was also at that time sort of very French. So if people assumed that I was French, I allowed them to think that, so I would avoid it. I had stopped writing after this episode. I wrote this down. By that time, I had filled trunks full of notebooks and scraps and paper, and so everything that I felt I was writing about. And I thought that after Bush went to war in Iraq, we were living in Italy at the time, I decided I had seriously to reconsider my notes and the idea of writing about this and writing it as a protest against war. My book is, the intention is to comment on how war affects children.
As opposed to being just your story.
Yes.
Because you're sort of an anomaly, aren't you? There haven't been any books written from the child's perspective, which is, and you say in your preface, there's some things you don't remember, you take some liberties in terms of historical fiction or whatever. But that's what sort of grabbed me, and I'm assuming will grab other people who read this book. You're a kid.
Right.
How do you make sense out of this? How do you do any of this, much less an adult trying to justify that? How did you survive?
My mother. My mother was a positive hero. My mother got us through. She was, to me, the most amazing person imaginable.
She when didn't. It doesn't make sense to you, how does can it possibly make sense to an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old?
It didn't.
Your father's not there. One sister's brought somewhere else.
It didn't make sense. But children become acclimatized to their surroundings in ways that I think I couldn't possibly explain, mm-hmm. except I constantly ask questions. Always. I was always full of questions. I still am a person full of questions.
And were your answers satisfactory to
you? No, because it was...
isn't my friend Monica, who used to be my friend,
right.
a friend
so this
now?
This was, you know, earlier when she called me a Jew pig and then I would go up in flames. It was my mother explained because we were Jewish that the Germans had made war on Jews. The day before my 6th birthday, my grandmother was taken away. And she was, like many Jews in Hamburg, sent to an instant death camp in Minsk, in Belarus, where she was made to strip and kneel with thousands of others in front of a mass grave. And shot. Now, my grandmother was one of these typically upper bourgeois, proper women, you know, very, very, very proper. And the idea of her stripping must have been even worse than being killed. I'll give you an example of how war affects people. I think war affects children in a totally different way, so that you live with the experience of war for the rest of
your life.
Even when you think that you have overcome, which I do, it turns out I considered myself a very tragic person in my teens. I'm actually quite an optimistic person for the most part. And I have been extremely lucky because I've been surrounded by love. I have the most amazingly loving husband. And he's you know, my real soulmate. My friends love me and I love them. So I'm surrounded by love. And we have a wonderful son, 2 grandsons. And I consider myself an extremely lucky person. I'm lucky because I'm alive as well.
Well, for
and
sure.
I appreciate that fact. But I'll give you an example. This past spring was one of those beautiful days after winter, and Daniel and I were walking along the Potomac River and just having fun, taking a break from working, and just enjoying ourselves. And for some reason, suddenly, and this day I cannot explain it, I was overcome by an anger that I hadn't felt since childhood. It was prompted by nothing that I could think of, but suddenly this image of my kneeling grandmother, naked, the deprivation of relatives, everything. I was so angry, my body was shaking. I was furious. I wanted to scream. I wanted to rant and rave. And I could, for the life of me, could not explain why this, you know, sudden sort of real physical aspect as well as this emotional anger suddenly overcame me, because I hadn't had that since I can't remember when, you know, this kind of really profound experience. But also recently having nightmares again, and I think it is because you hear about drones killing, and this, of course, you know, sets up in me equally, you know, some response that is probably different from the response somebody else might have.
So you get this overwhelming, incredible anger.
Yes.
And as quickly as it overtakes you, Are you also saying that it dissipates?
It dissipated, but it left behind something that I thought was gone. It left behind a kind of total frustration and a total...
defeatism?
Yes, I just don't understand how we can continue to do what we are doing or to people. Just this amazing... the things that we are doing now, that people doing to each other, it's Israel and Palestine, it is
and
what
Syria.
We are doing in Syria. You know, it makes you question whether we as a human race are deficient in some way that this is our default setting.
I guess what I'm struck by is, yes, as you see this more on a global scale, I'm just looking at it from one person. I mean, you know, that's really all very well and good to say life is terrible, but I know it's terrible because I suffered through it.
I relate to this because I experienced it.
Right, and you weren't, you know, nobody liked you because you were Jewish. I mean, and that was the beginning and the end of it.
I went to school after the war in Hamburg for the first time.
Yeah, I can't believe your family went back to Hamburg. Is that only because you didn't know where else to go?
No. What happened was that when we were in hiding— my father found us after the war ended, and we were as a nuclear family together, my father, my mother, my two sisters, and I. But everybody else in my mother's family had been killed, about 50 people approximately. And my father was imprisoned by the Nazis because he was helping Belgian Jews. After the war, I went to school for the first time. If a teacher indicates in a classroom that a child is not as likable as
the next one,
the children pick up on that. And this
that happens today.
Yes, and the child becomes the butt of everybody's bullying. Well, obviously, that's what happened to me. So that on my way to school in the morning, leaving, I was picked on, spat on, called names.
But you didn't know any other way, did you?
No, I'm. But
growing up, I mean, did you? Was there any normalcy in your life?
No, there was not. And I complained, and I told my parents that I didn't want to go to school, that I wanted not to go to school. And I begged my father, because in Europe and at that time, you know, father still headed the households, and my father insisted that I go to school and that I continue in that school. And I said, it's unfair. And they beat me, and my teachers hate me. And my father said, you know, the 6 million Jews had been killed. And he said, you survived. And he said, it is your job to show that they are wrong. It is your job to show how bright you are, how beautiful you are, and you are the inheritor of 6 million people, and you have to stand up for them because they were killed and they didn't have a voice. You are their voice. I hated my father for that.
That's a burden, isn't it? That's a heavy burden.
I hated him. I fought with him. I thought he was mean and cruel. I am so grateful to him now. I cannot tell you. I think that what my father taught me to speak out, speak up, never be quiet. Nelson Mandela, who has shown that revenge and vengeance isn't the way to live. It is reconciliation is a way to peace. And he has shown that it works. Gandhi has shown that you don't have to take arms. The civil rights movement has shown us that it is possible to live other than just to be aggressive. I think that one of the other things that I learned is, in some ways, imagine if I were German and my father were a Nazi. What an unlivable burden that would have been if that had been my legacy. Imagine that, you know, to have, you know, to know that your father, you know, was one of the killers of people. You know, I would have had to kill myself. I don't think I could have lived that way. So in some ways, it's ironic, but you can say, you know, better to be the victim than the victimizer. The other thing that I'm that concerns me today is what we are doing here. We are so divided in our society. We have children who go to bed hungry every single night, and I can relate to that because I've been hungry. I've spent, you know, the entire war years hungry because as Jews we couldn't get ration cards. So, you know, we had to rely if somebody, you know, was willing to give us something to eat. And so there were days on end when we didn't have anything to eat. And I remember after the war, you know, a couple of years after the war, when I ate my first banana and I got violently sick because my system was unused to eating
something healthy.
Something healthy. Mm-hmm. And so it bothers me, and I'm in some ways voiceless,
powerless.
I do not have the, you know, the recognition to be able to shake people, you know, by the shoulder and say, "Hey, stop it!"
A reason for this book then?
Yes, all of this is the reason, and for the second book, which is going to come out in autumn next year, which talks about the civil rights era.
Well, obviously, you have had your work cut out for you for many, many years, and it sounds like you're going to have many, many more years to do really great things.
Now I have, you know, a 7 and an 11-year-old grandson, and you know, you have to.
They know certainly about your past.
The 11-year-old who is a big reader and, you know, very cerebral, he knows about it, and he, in fact, he asked very interesting. I had when the book came out earlier this year, a talk at Politics and Prose, which is, you know, sort of a preeminent place for authors to present their works in Washington. And so after my presentation, there were questions, and the second person to get up was Sam, who was not yet 11.
Your grandson?
Yes. And so I thought to myself, oh, my God, what is Sam going to ask? And then I had been talking about the 500 Jewish women who were, this is, again, you know, one of the things that concerns me about governments and how they operate. During the Holocaust, 500 Jewish women had been taken out of Auschwitz and brought to Essen to work in the crop factories. They were treated more cruelly than the prisoners of war and Jewish men. They were not given warm clothing. They were not given shoes. They were not allowed to seek shelter during bombing raids. They were not allowed to use toilets. They were just treated in a way that is unimaginable. And America gave Krupp. He was in prison for only 4 years for war crimes, and it was a cushy prison. I mean, he did not suffer. And America gave him $80 million and made him one of the richest men in the universe. And furthermore, American politicians and Americans vied to go grouse hunting in his estates, which were bigger, I think, than Central Park or something like that. So this makes you, you know, this just, you know, brings up the anger. This brings up your frustration.
Sure.
This makes you want to fight. And I'm not a physical fighter. You know, I want to fight. That's why I wrote the book. I want to say, you know, think about it. Think about doing it in another way. So Sam got up, and so he said, and I had been talking about the women, and so Sam said, I just want to ask about why was the dude Krupp not brought to justice? Why was justice not done? And I thought that was a very good and amazing question from a 10-year-old. And so I said, you know, this is what I've been asking also, Sam. I don't know. And so this is, you know, this is comes from a 10-year-old
right.
asking a 77-year-old, mm-hmm. why, and the 70-year-old still can't answer,
well,
and can't answer this question. But I will tell you something positive. Because there are positive things. You know, the world is not all black. I went back to Mississippi a few weeks ago. At the urging of Daniel, you know, he kept saying, you know, for the second book, you should really see what Mississippi is like, especially Moss Point, where you lived, and Pascagoula, where your school was. And I said, I don't want to go back. I really do not want to go back. So he said, think about it. You know, I think it would really be a good idea. So we went, and some of my students were there. And one of them, who had lived behind the school and had witnessed the burning cross, said to me that I had instilled in her a love of books and reading, so she became a librarian.
Wonderful.
Another student had become the first black woman mayor of Moss
Point.
Huge. And another had become the black police chief. And these women were strong women. One of the women, her two children integrated the local schools. These people are not going to be turned around by the anti-voter movement that is going on. They fought hard, and they are going to not be complacent about what is happening, because we are back to a state almost like 1930 Germany, against the anti-union movement, the no longer really a freedom of the press.
Right.
And especially voter suppression. And this is what the Nazis used, exactly these things to
right.
make their movement. But I think that young people will prevail. I think that eventually these people will die out. At least this is my optimistic hope, because young people are not anti-gay. Young people are not anti-black. They're not anti-Hispanics.
Right.
They're not anti-women. They are...
Well, they learn from us, too, and they can turn it around.
Yes, yes.
That's wonderful.
And so I think that our hope is that maybe in another 10, 20 years, there will be a change. But we are going to have to fight. We are going to have to make our...
Like you,
we need to make our voices heard to make sure that this is not going to be...
the status quo.
Yes, or that we are silent.
Exactly. Well, everybody should get their hands on The Hands of War, A Tale of Endurance and Hope from a Survivor of the Holocaust. It was a real pleasure to meet you, Marianne, and I wish you wonderful success.
Thank you,
You're really
Thank
quite
you.
A story. You have quite a story to tell.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. And if you'd like to reach the 51%, contact us at advertising@51%.com/conversations.com. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at the 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.